We made this.
Hi everyone, Carl here. On this podcast, I was really pleased to join Robert Bellissimo on his YouTube channel to discuss 1931's Little Caesar. You may remember Robert from the Movie Palace episode from earlier this year on Hitchcock's Rope. Now, Robert's a great guy and I always have a lot of fun chatting with him. So if you like our discussion here, do consider tracking down some of his other work. So search for Robert Bellissimo at the Movies, which is the name of his show, and you can find him on Twitter, where he's at RB at the Movies. Okay, listeners, let's get on with today's episode.
In this video, we are going to be talking about the pre-code classic gangster film, Little Caesar, which starred Edward G. Robinson. It was released in 1931, and it was directed by Mervyn LeRoy. My guest today is Carl Sweeney, who has been on my channel before. He has a podcast called the Movie Palace Podcast, where he explores classical film, which you can find anywhere that podcasts are released on any platform. So, Carl, I want to thank you again for joining me.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine, Robert. It's great to be with you again. We've had a couple of good chats in the past, haven't we? And I'm sure this will be a nice one too. Really looking forward to it, actually.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I had watched Little Caesar, actually. So this has been a very nice reason to do so. So, yeah.
Yeah, same here. And as I was saying earlier, it was a lot. It's a lot more powerful than I remember. But just before we jump into that, because I know, of course, you have the classic movie, the Movie Palace podcast, all about classic film. Do you do you consciously look into pre-code cinema, or like, have you actually explored that time period, or do you mainly look at, you know, the post pre-code up until the rating system?
No, I like pre-code cinema. We've done some episodes in the past on pre-code films. I think one that springs to mind immediately is I did a podcast, actually fairly similar to this in some ways. We did a podcast on The Public Enemy.
Oh, yeah.
Another seminal gangster film from I think it came out just a few months after this one. So no, it's a fascinating period, isn't it? And it seems like it's got a really, you know, there's a big kind of pre-code fan base online, it seems like to me. Like, there was something going on this year called Pre-Code April, which seems to have been getting a bit of traction. So yeah, it's an interesting period. That period before they start to enforce these rules, which would really look odd, you know, from a contemporary standpoint, don't know some of the things that American cinema put in place with the code. So yeah, I like the period a lot.
Well, it's quite fascinating because I never, until I started this podcast, and of course I knew Public Enemy and Little Caesar and other films, I never really thought in terms of pre-code. I always just thought, oh, that's the classic Hollywood era. But doing this podcast and meeting, you know, guests that you have had on, mutual friends of ours, Vanessa Putino, Raquel Stetcher, and they were the ones who really got me into this. And you're right, there is this community that really explore this time period from 1929 until 1934, because I'm still in awe of some of the movies I see and like what they were talking about, and the content is so ahead of its time that some of these movies, they look like they could be made right now, which is, and I think there is more of a conscious effort to actually sort of, not so much a subgenre, but to separate it as opposed to, well, this is classic Hollywood, but to say, well, no, this was a very distinctive time. And I know more and more books have come out on it. Are there some other pre-code favorites of yours that you've maybe only discovered in the last few years that you really like?
I'm not sure about that I've really discovered in the past few years. I mean, there probably are. I just have to look. I'm one of those people who logs stuff on Letterboxd, otherwise I never remember what I've watched, you know. I like some pre-code horror stuff, you know, like those early films like Dracula and Frankenstein. Yeah. I think what's interesting, and it ties back to the gangster film, is you sort of see some of these like moral panics around films of the early 1930s is quite fascinating, isn't it? Like how a film like Little Caesar or Dracula or Frankenstein can cause kind of disquiet when we look at them today, and we're sort of so far removed from them that can be quite striking, can't it?
Yeah.
But no, I think, yeah, so I'd say that. I think I like the period very much. And the public reaction to some of these films is a fascinating aspect of it too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, the classic horror you mentioned as well, like I never thought of Frankenstein or Dracula as like very much a period of pre-code cinema. Yeah. And of course you can see such a difference between Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, which was the sequel.
Yeah. Well, no, I was just going to say, you can also, there's with some of those films, what seems to happen when the code comes out is they then, some of these films get re-released years later with like scenes cut out.
You know,
I think there's a scene in Frankenstein that's cut out and wasn't restored into it until many, many years later.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that affected things like The Public Enemy as well. And I feel, whenever I hear about that, I always feel like a pang of anger and injustice.
You know, yeah.
How could they do that to something that's so...
Oh, I know, to people's art, to people's work. Yeah. But looking at that, this film, Little Caesar, coming at it again and looking at it again, what was your impression this time around? How did you feel about it?
Okay, well, I'll be honest. I thought when I suggested to you, like, hey, how about we talk about Little Caesar? Partly I was thinking, well, it's a really interesting film because of where it comes in, like the history of the gangster film and all of that. But what I was remembering was the film itself is not necessarily that great. I remember that Edward G. Robinson is really captivating in it. And I think that absolutely remains the case from my most recent rewatch. I think he's really powerful here.
I agree.
But the film around him was better than I remembered, I've got to say. And I'm interested to hear your take on it. I just remembered it being nowhere near as good as things like The Public Enemy or Scarface, even though it kind of predates them and is like comparable to them. So I was pleasantly surprised to find it quite taut and exciting. I'd also forgotten how short it is. And I know we talked about this off air in terms of like, it's actually quite good as a podcaster when you come up with something with a short running time for preparation.
Yeah, yeah, particularly when you're doing a lot of reviews at once, right? Yeah. And you're thinking, okay, great, this is short.
Well, I think it really does have a feel of, it's quite muscular and obviously that feeling of brevity, even though there may be one or two scenes here which, to be honest, for me, whenever Robinson's not on the screen, it's not as interesting because I think a lot of it goes back to him.
Yeah.
But overall, I was pleasantly surprised having not seen it for a few years and returning to it for this. How about you?
Yeah, no, I agree. I really enjoyed it. And I remember the same thing. I remember Edward G. Robertson being great, but it not being as good as, say, Scarface or The Public Enemy overall. But it's been a while since I've seen the original Scarface. I'm not sure when people hear Scarface, they think Al Pacino, but we're talking about the Paul Muni, 1932, the original. But I would have to revisit Scarface because I haven't seen the original in quite a few years. But I don't know. I would put it right up there with Public Enemy because I think its themes in terms of self-destruction and sort of the American dream gone to shit, so to speak. I mean, Edward G. Robinson is as a Rico, as Caesar, he's already a violent gangster off the top, but you know, you see him robbing a gas station and he's like this small time hood with his partner, and he will do anything to become not just successful but also rich, and he's in the tabloids, and these are all things that were very much against the code of being a gangster, which you certainly saw in later films and even in real life. I don't know how familiar you are with the real life gangster John Gotti, but he was like a celebrity. Like he was in the news, he was in the newspaper, and he loved it, from what I've heard anyways. You see that in this movie, like that one scene where he poses for the pictures, the newspaper, and he's happy to do so, and that other gangster just leaves. I'm not gonna get seen in the newspaper. But his ego and his pride and his greed and his thirst for, you know, success and fame and money at all costs certainly is his downfall. So it's very much the rags to riches, back to the rags story. And as quickly as he goes up, he goes down equally as fast. I mean, I think that then again, that goes to the running time, which... in my opinion, there are some problems with the fact that it was that short, which I want to get into it in a bit. But I'm curious what you felt was the heart of the film. Like, what do you think it was truly about?
What surprised me coming back to the film was that it doesn't really try to explain Rico at all. Do you know what I mean? I couldn't quite remember how it started. Because I remember films like The Public Enemy, where it starts with the Cagney character as a child and things. And you get a real sense of like where this person came from, the factors that have shaped his approach to criminality and things like that. Little Caesar's quite odd then, isn't it? Because there's none of that. We just pick up with him as a hardened criminal already.
Yeah, it jumps. It jumps right into what he wants.
Yeah. So I think for me, it's about him as kind of a force of nature and all the things you were touching on earlier about the rags to riches, back to rags, the rise and fall structure. I think it's like a really interesting like prototype of that in terms of, this is not like the earliest. I think there's kind of a common misconception sometimes where people think films like Little Caesar and The Public Enemy are where the gangster films started, which is not really the case, because you, you can go back to the silent era and see films like The Musketeers of Pig Alley, or Joseph von Sternberg made a film, Underworld, in I think it's 1927, which is a very good gangster film. But I think Little Caesar's great because it's the sound era. I think sound's really important to the gangster film. And it's not just, like, obviously the sound of gunfire is a big part of that. And like, you know, the tires squealing and, you know, breaking glass or whatever. I think a lot of that's to do with the actors, because I think actors we associate with gangster films are often very distinctive vocally, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. I mean, when I was watching this, I couldn't help but think of, you know, Joe Pesci. I could see Joe Pesci in that part, the Caesar part. A lot of, and, you know, Scorsese, this is, of course, is the Warner Brothers film, and Scorsese was a major fan of the Warner Brothers gangster films. But you're right in terms of, you don't see his childhood or anything before the opening scene where he robs a gas station and he's like, let's go east, we got to become big and get, and, you know, go for glory and stuff like that. Like, whereas opposed to something like Angels with Dirty Faces, which I really like, and I'm not saying that you shouldn't necessarily show the whys behind the behavior, like, very much in that movie, you know why those two, one guy became a priest and one guy became a hood, as they were friends as kids. In this film, you don't know why. And I think I actually really like films where you don't necessarily know why, because then it forces the audience to ask themselves, well, why might that be? You know, I'm rereading Sidney Lumet's book, Making Movies, for the review you're planning. And he had this great quote where, because when he would be about to film a movie, and maybe a producer or someone would have a problem because maybe he didn't always necessarily give the psychology behind why the characters were doing what they were doing. And he referred to that as the rubber ducky. It's like, everyone needs the rubber ducky, and the rubber ducky referring to, well, the guy became a murderer because his mom took his rubber ducky in the bathtub. Yeah. And in other words, you don't necessarily need to know, which makes it far more interesting in my view. I don't know how you felt about that.
Yeah, well, it's odd though, in terms of, you think of gangsters in terms of film gangsters, and you think, well, he's going to have a wife, he's probably going to have another girlfriend on the side.
Yeah,
he's going to have some interesting kind of, you know, maybe his mother's going to come into the picture, and we don't get any of that, do we? With Rico, like, he's got no interest whatsoever in women.
Yeah,
we don't meet his family. So it seemed like it's kind of a classic gangster film in terms of its template, in terms of he goes up and then he comes down, but it's missing some of the kind of trappings. But in other ways, it isn't missing them, because it does have the thing where, you know, he acquires things as he goes along. You know, he acquires a nickname and an image, and his clothes get a bit sharper,
right?
The watch, he's given a watch at some point, isn't he? So he gets all the kind of markers of success. So I guess in terms of the heart of the film, I think you can sort of see that rise to success as a big part of it, because that's really fundamental to gangster stories.
Yes. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, this certainly mirrored Scarface a great deal, I found, both the original and the remake with Pacino was quite close to the actual original. Just they changed where he was from and different political reasons for why Tony Montana was doing what he was doing. But what I really liked that I don't see as much in gangster films was the amount of fear we see in the gangsters, particularly that one character, Tony, who was the driver after that heist they pull off. And he is scared to death, to the point where he can't even get rid of the car. I mean, he crashes the car and abandons it. And he has this really, and actually I thought the performances were great. Him and his mother in this scene where he's like crying in his room, and, you know, because at this point the police have an ID on what he looked like, and he doesn't even want to be involved with this gang anymore. And at the same time, he knows that they might kill him for what, that there's that possibility of him talking to the police about what he knows. You know, you saw that in later movies, gangsters getting caught, and in real life, gangsters getting caught and then what they would call ratting out their associates to save themselves. So there's always that danger when the police are after you that, you know, we saw that in Goodfellas as well. You know, like if the cops know something on you and they're after you, then now you're a risk. And when he's alone there, the actor's actually William Collier Jr. as Tony Passa. And this scene where his mother just is, doesn't, you get the impression she doesn't even necessarily know what he's up to, and talks about his past with the priest and the better times, and he was a good boy, and now she doesn't know what's wrong with him, and he can't tell her what's going on, and she doesn't know how to help him other than to hug him. And I actually, you forget, which happens a lot in gangster films, because you can't help but sometimes empathize with them based on what's happening in the story. But I forget that this guy's actually a criminal, and it's a touching scene. I don't know if that stood out to you in terms of the fear, the amount of fear we saw in these guys.
Yeah, you're right. It's quite striking. And I think there's that theme of, you know, Rico is like quite well suited to this life. Like he takes to it really naturally. And then you've got characters like Joe, haven't you, played by Douglas Fairbanks Jr., who he's kind of the counterpoint, isn't he? Because when Rico's talking about wanting to make it big in, when they say go east, they presumably mean move to Chicago, although it's never explicitly referred to as Chicago on screen, is it? It seems like.
Yeah, I think it's loosely on Al Capone, right? And I read it's also loosely on another well-known gangster at the time, but.
Capone is like the main reference point I've heard. And that's an interesting thing to consider, isn't it? In terms of what the public at the time would have made of Little Caesar.
Right.
Because I think there's a sense that Warner Brothers were making films that were kind of ripped from the headlines. You know, they could turn around films based on topical events quite quickly.
Yes.
And I think that plays into the success of the gangster sort of cycle of this era with this film and The Public Enemy and so on and so forth. So I think, the thing that like Robinson has a certain resemblance to Capone, doesn't he? Capone was like all over the press since the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, I believe.
Right.
You know, I think Capone, we're talking about the rise to success. And I think that's important because people have described it as having this comparison to the American dream, you know, kind of like the dark mirror of the American dream, because the gangsters aren't doing things the right way. You know, they're self-made men, but they're doing it by killing and stealing and all of that. And like Capone, when he would talk to reporters and things, would sort of position himself as like an entrepreneur is like the suggestion I've seen, you know? So I think when we say like the film doesn't explain where this guy comes from and all of that, I think we probably have to think, well, that's maybe because the viewers at the time would have readily associated this with people like Capone that they're
familiar
with from the media. So you don't necessarily need to do a big sociological thing diving into the childhood or whatever.
Yeah.
Because people have that kind of cultural touchstone, which they're, my understanding is people readily accepted that this was a thinly veiled look at someone like Capone or an adaptation of that kind of figure, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree. I imagine so. And I think that also played into the running time because of how much of a story they would have told. I mean, if you had gone into his childhood and even expanded on some of the reactions the characters were having, particularly the guys he was working with, you would have needed at least another half an hour, which to me, that was part of the flaws in this, because Rico, Edward G. Robinson's character, Caesar, he comes into this gang, he gets hired by this gang, and it's interesting how he takes over. And, you know, there's the famous line of what he says to the boss, you can dish it out, but you can't take it, which has become such an iconic line. But at the same time, maybe because we've seen so many gangster films since then, like if you were to realistically go after the head of the gang you're in, they wouldn't back. I find it hard to believe that the guy would have backed down that easily. And he even says that one scene to his associates when Rico kills the police commissioner at that heist. And that was a big no-no because they were saying, you know, this guy's on to us. Even the other gangs that they were working with were saying, let's not be so trigger happy. Let's watch our violence. And because this guy's, you know, he's on and he doesn't care, Caesar. I mean, he just shoots that guy, you know, because the guy happened to be right there in the place at the time. And, you know, he just does whatever he wants. And I think at the time when he says to the gang, his boss, Sam, says, oh, yeah, well, I don't think anyone's going to be with you on you trying to take over. And no one answers when, you know, and I imagine that they either didn't know what to do or they didn't know where their loyalties lied, or they liked Caesar more. Maybe they felt he was more powerful. It's quite ambiguous, but I just thought the fact that the guy just kind of laid down and let Caesar take over was way too convenient. I don't know if was a red flag to you.
I'm not sure I'd say a red flag, but I could definitely see what you mean. And I think there is a sense, isn't there, that the film, when you look at what they actually avoid talking about, it's interesting. The fact that I don't think prohibition is actually really referred to in the film, right. Even though I could have sworn that it was when I was thinking back to my last time I'd seen it. Because films like The Public Enemy, you know, it is a big part of that. So you don't really get it. I'm assuming, I mean, I've heard some speculation that maybe there's a sense of them here being quite wary about the censors, and maybe there are certain aspects of that. But also the fact that quite a lot of the violence happens like off screen, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of interesting. I mean, that first opening scene where it's done in one shot, it's like a gas station, I guess you call it, wouldn't you? Where it's all done from the outside and all of that. And like that, when they, it's the New Year's Eve thing, isn't it? Where you get quite a weird in the club. It's like done for a weird series of dissolves where you can't really see what's going on. You know, you can't, I think there was a sense with gangster films that they're often accused of like giving people kind of like the blueprints for how to commit crimes and things, but you don't really see how that heist exactly plays out because it's done that quite impressionistic series of dissolves.
it was all dissolves, and it was done so quickly with the editing.
It's weird though, isn't it? Because the rest of the film didn't really have that style. It just was for that set piece. So there's some really interesting like rough edges to Little Caesar, I think.
Yeah. No, I absolutely. But I just found that I the only thing I can imagine, I can't know for sure, was that because this was something quite new at the time, the audience would accept someone just backing down. But now that we've seen, you know, things like The Godfather and Goodfellas and even The Sopranos, I think we know a bit more that would be something that would not have. You're asking for a war, basically. Like, I don't think he would have been able to take over a gang so easily. And then when the other gang tries to kill him, you know, again, he's in the press. You know, also, like, there was a lot of attention for killing that police commissioner. Like, it's this guy is someone who's just asking for trouble again and again and again. And when they miss him, when they just shoot his arm, he goes and just tells that guy to leave town. And that was another thing I thought. I'm surprised he didn't hit back, or I mean, maybe he would have thought it would have just ended up in more violence, but he seemed like the kind of guy who who would have just like got his gun and went in there and blown everyone to bits. I don't know. Yeah. How did you feel about that?
Well, because is that the part where we get like an insert shot of like the newspaper report?
Yes. That the guy went to Detroit and they kind of made light of it, that he was on a vacation or something, and everyone was laughing.
Yeah, I thought that was funny. And I thought that on the commentary I listened to on the DVD earlier, I can't remember the gentleman's name, but the guy doing the commentary was saying that he thinks there was maybe an implication, or there was supposed to be an implication, that the guy didn't really leave town, but that the gangsters had taken care of him. But I didn't take it that way when I saw the film.
Neither did I.
Maybe something's missing in the editing or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it was sort of like, you know, I got the impression that he told the guy, you miss me, so you leave or you're next. And it was also peculiar because that guy had a boss. And then when they told that other character, the guy just looked scared, like as if, well, now he's going to have to deal with Rico or something. So there were some elements that I thought didn't quite...
like gel or something.
Yeah, just didn't quite gel. And whereas though I appreciated that we saw more cowardly behavior from the gangsters and a lot more fear, which you really don't see as much in other gangster movies. You certainly see fear, like in Henry Hill and Goodfellas and Michael Corleone and The Godfather, but it's very, very subtle. But in this case, it was very explosive. These guys were wanting to get out of this life and, and wanting, particularly his partner played by Douglas Fairbanks, off the top, you know, he wants to be a dancer, which was so unusual. I just thought that was such a creative choice.
It is unusual. And I had forgotten that, like you say, he wants to be a dancer. When you said the terms red flag earlier, and with the scenes with Joe and with is Olga, isn't it?
Yes, his girl, the woman he meets that he falls in love with.
I found them a bit less captivating than the stuff with Rico. But what interested me this time was, you know, the fact that, so he's basically trying to get out of this life or whatever, which is a fairly common gangster film theme, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
But I suppose the implication at the end is that he's succeeded, right? Because like Rico is obviously gunned down.
Right.
And then we see the billboard of Joe and Olga on the, you know, that he kind of was gunned down in front of or behind or whatever. So it seems like he has succeeded. He has managed to disassociate himself from the criminal world.
Yes.
And I'd forgotten that. I had forgotten that the film ended on that image of the billboard.
Well, and that's, you know, it's interesting because earlier in the film, he says, I think he says to Olga, well, not too many people get out of this once you're in. And that, you know, we know that about gang. Once you're in, you know, like the classic Godfather 3 line, once I thought it was out, they pulled me back in, right? There's no leaving. And obviously this is much more of a idealistic look at this guy getting out, and it's a little too convenient. There was an episode, I don't know how familiar you are with Sopranos, but where another character wanted completely out and ends up hanging himself because he couldn't get out. I actually interviewed the actor on the show, Robert Funaro. It's one of the best episodes of Sopranos. But when I was watching this, it reminded me of so many things that we saw later that perhaps were much more detailed and richer. But certainly, as you said, it has all of the essence and the hallmarks and the great things we saw later, just that this was perhaps more, you know, clean and convenient and quick.
Yeah, because it has quite a clear, unfussy style, doesn't it?
You know,
if you think about some of the great gangster films, and the one I always go to immediately is Goodfellas. I don't know how you feel about that film.
Yeah, oh yeah, classic.
Just wonderful manipulation of filmic technique in that film. What's interesting about these early films is like how direct they are, you know.
Yes.
I suppose that heist scene in the at New Year's Eve is just maybe an exception because of the dissolves that come in, but generally it's just a, you know, clear and cluttered film. I was wondering what you think about, because I think what a lot of people think about gangsters in films is that because they rise and then they fall, we sort of live vicariously as they climb the ladder, you know. We enjoy them succeeding. We enjoy them advancing through the world, the underworld, and then we kind of have a level of catharsis as they do get their comeuppance, you know. But I was wondering, like, how do we identify with Rico? Because he's such an exaggerated figure in some ways, and that's what's really fun about him. It's quite a stylized performance. But you know, the classic gangster characters, they're not like everyman figures, are they? You know, they're kind of, we sort of take a different approach to them, I think. Do you know what I mean? They're not heroes. I think anti-hero is the term you use. There's a mythic aspect in them, isn't there? They're kind of like folk anti-heroes or something. Do you know what I mean?
Well, you know, it's an interesting topic about why has the public always been so fascinated with gangster films to this day? I mean, there's obviously a lot less of them made nowadays. I mean, like the last one really, I guess, was Scorsese's Irishman. And I suppose that they have those elements of that they are human, but they have a part of them, large part of them is very evil. And I think that the elements in terms of Caesar, that his ambition and his thirst for success at all costs, I think that is very much what a lot of people probably, I imagine, relate to, particularly American audiences, because the American dream is very much alive and well to this day. And it's unfortunate that people just don't quite understand that they can hurt people along that journey. You know, when your ambition is when you want something so badly, you can destroy yourself and others around you. And I certainly can relate to a time when I was, you know, willing to only think of myself or something I wanted, and how that could hurt those around me. But, you know, he happens to be a gangster, but I'm thinking, you know, you look at something like Death of the Salesman. Willie Loman is a guy who is, he deludes himself on how successful he is. And he's very naive. He thinks that as long as he acts a certain way and does a certain thing, that he's the greatest thing on earth. And he lies to himself, and his sons lie to themselves as a result of that same kind of upbringing. And that's very much where that sort of clean cut way of looking at life. Well, as long as I do this, I should be able to acquire this. And then if I don't, well, what the hell happened? You know, it's like nothing is that simple. And I think in terms of this film anyways, I think that is probably where people can see themselves in a guy like Caesar. I don't know how you felt about that.
Well, he's got those human frailties, hasn't he? He's got the sense of vanity. You know, I think Robinson's really good, you know, sometimes when you see him like combing his hair and all of that. And how taken in he is by the idea of getting his picture in the paper. And then when the paper's released, he goes out to buy 10 copies of it, all of that. So yeah, like vanity and pride and all of this.
Yeah,
I suppose the factor that's relevant in terms of how people would have taken this at the time, there's a few things. Obviously, there's the fact that it's an early sound film. And like I said, I think sound's really important to like making gangster films distinctive. There's what's going on with Capone in the press, well, in Chicago, and then taken up by the mass media. And then there's the fact that America's going through a really tough time economically as well, aren't they?
Right.
With the Great Depression. So you've got that idea of, the gangsters continue to appeal, maybe not to the extent of the early 30s, where you were getting, I believe I'd seen some stat, like there were 100 gangster films released in America between 1930 and 1932 or something like that.
Wow.
Just like a huge amount, yeah.
Holy.
Because I think once things like Little Caesar had been successful, there was a very quick impetus to imitate, you know?
Yeah.
So I think, the fact that there's this wider hardship at the time with what's going on in the country probably plays into it. I mean, that probably makes people feel like these are like modern day Robin Hood figures or something. Do you know what I mean? Outside the establishment.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that still holds up to this day. I mean, they asked Al Pacino when he was doing press for The Irishman, why are people so interested in these kind of characters? And he said, there's something about people who live outside the law that people are attracted to. And I also sometimes wonder if, you know, all of us are in positions where we maybe have a boss we don't like, and we wish we can just tell that person off or but that the consequences are too great. And I think when we see people just these kind of characters who often just don't take crap, not everybody. I mean, we see that some of these characters in this are very, very terrified. And I think that's probably very true but there is that element of toughness and threatening figures that people perhaps wish they had that kind of quality. I remember when Trump was the president, and even when he very much tells people off and he doesn't care. And I wondered if that was part of his appeal to people. Not that I liked it. I wondered if people felt that they saw those qualities in him and they wanted that in themselves. And not that people necessarily kill anybody, but we all have these feelings that we explore in one way or another in our imagination or have you. And I think seeing him just be so rude and disrespectful and say whatever he wants and tell people off and, you know, often face no consequences. I think unfortunately, people sort of gravitate towards that. And I think it goes to these kind of movies as well. I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, is it unfortunate? Because, I mean, that's one of the interesting things about Little Caesar, isn't it? Is the fact that it provoked quite disapproving reactions. And like I said, I think that's quite hard to understand from like our vantage point. But I think there was a congressman who had, an Italian-American congressman who had objected to Robinson's portrayal because he was unmistakably Italian-American. I suppose that's the other interesting thing about The Coming of Sound, is that the issue of the ethnicity of the gangsters comes to the fore a bit more, doesn't it?
Yeah.
There was also someone who, Dr. James Wingate, who was the head of the motion picture division of the State of New York Education Department. And apparently his like decisions on things like censorship were quite influential. And he said about Little Caesar, children see a gangster riding around in a Rolls Royce and living in luxury. And even though some of the gangster gets him in the end, the child unconsciously forms the idea that he will be smarter and will get away with it. But I think what Wingate, he insisted that the film was cut quite extensively in New York, and then there were other places that followed suit. But I don't know. From my perspective, I think that does a disservice to the audience in a way, because we don't just passively, you know, accept and imitate all of these things, do we? Or I suppose he's talking about formative. He's talking about on the effect on children, where it's a bit more, you know, it's, maybe it's a different thing when children are growing up at a certain age. I don't know. But I don't like that sort of censorious attitude, I guess is what I'm saying, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I don't either, because I think, you know, it's interesting that people had those perspectives. And I think people have similar perspectives when these kind of characters are up on the screen nowadays. I know when The Sopranos came out that people were concerned of how it was portraying Italian Americans and stuff like that. But at the same time, these are fragments of society, and they are social realities. So if the concern is that it's going to influence, you know, children in the wrong way, I really don't think, I mean, I'm not an expert, I can't say for sure, but I don't think a movie could really make anyone violent. I think that often is, people have qualities that are built into them because they're born into violence or they're brought up in violence, very much like these people. And I can remember, I don't know about you, but I can remember when I was young and in high school, and the way I got into movies, because I had a friend who was obsessed with gangster films, and he showed me Goodfellas, Donnie Brasco, Scarface, the Al Pacino Scarface. And it was almost to the point where he thought he was going to be go into this world, you know, and very naive and childlike. And it kind of goes back to the to kids playing with guns, you know, cowboys and the cops and robbers kind of scenario. And I think it's that we have these qualities, but of violence in us, but we may think that we're going to actually do something, but I think often people don't. I think if you're hurting someone, it's because there's something's happened to you in your life, or I don't think a movie could do that to someone. Again, I'm not an expert. I'm sure it's happened, but it's certainly not common. I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, you've got to look at, I think you've probably got to look at broader issues like access to guns and.
Exactly. And,
all sorts of other social factors that can be addressed, you know.
There
probably is. I wonder if there is kind of a symbiotic thing, though, where I've heard about real life gangsters who really like The Godfather, you know.
And
I think that's one of the interesting things with The Sopranos, isn't it, is that they do refer back to films like Goodfellas and The Godfather.
Yes, and like even Public Enemy. There's a scene where Tony Soprano is watching and he actually starts to cry because of how much the mother is loving the son and how his mother in the show didn't love him. So it's, again, it was looking at these different sides of these people.
Yeah. And I suppose you've also got to think the real life world of gangsterism is appealing. If it wasn't appealing, people wouldn't go into it in the way that they do. So I think if a film doesn't portray these in kind of environments as something that can lead to a success of a kind, financial success, you know, kind of conspicuous consumption, it would be kind of dishonest, wouldn't it? Like, that's the thing I always think with Goodfellas. Is like, it really draws you into that world and you understand the appeal of it compared to, you know, conventional society.
Yes.
You know, you understand why Henry Hill doesn't really like school, but he likes that job he takes on and and all of that. So I think there is maybe some truth to it when that quote I read out, when he says, the gangster always gets it in the end. There is sometimes a sense with Little Caesar or films like it that the fall, it doesn't get the same amount of attention, does it? Like, it's
that's a good
the last
point.
5 minutes of Little Caesar, or 6 or 7 minutes or something.
Same with Goodfellas. I mean, people, you see, like, look at where this guy ends up, him and his family at the high for the rest of their life, and he still doesn't learn his lesson. He still ends looking right at the camera saying that he's a schnook.
Yeah, and it's really good, isn't it, how it portrays how mundane the life in the witness protection program is, you know?
So
I think that's one of the interesting things of, like, the pre-code era here, but also when the code comes in, is sometimes the way these stories are wrapped up in the moralistic way isn't the most convincing aspect of them. I do like the ending here, and of course we get the famous line, don't we, with Mother of Mercy, is this the end of Rico?
Yeah,
that's kind of interesting that he speaks of himself in the third person. I think that's kind of indicates that he is a kind of larger than life figure.
Yeah,
that's kind of what I meant earlier when I was saying, you know, there's a mythic quality to them. They sort of take on that aspect, and I think maybe that's because, I mean, there are probably various reasons for it, but like the rise and fall plot, that goes all the way back to things like Greek tragedy, doesn't it?
You know. Oh, of course. Yeah.
So I think it's really interesting with the 1930s gangster films that they sort of took this like age-old narrative structure, bolted it onto like contemporary subject matter. And I think it's just fascinating how impactful that was. Like, there's some story about a Little Caesar premiere. Let's see. Reportedly over 3,000 people showed up for the film's opening in New York.
Yeah, it was huge.
And the pressure of their bodies broke the glass doors of the Strand Theatre at Broadway and 47th Street, apparently.
Wow.
Yeah, that's incredible, isn't it? I mean,
it really is incredible. And you brought up a really good point, which is true, that often the glamour of these lie of these stories, even though often the gangster always gets it in the end. And that goes for every single gangster movie. But yeah, you're right. People are always more attracted to the early parts of those stories. And, you know, you look at Godfather, I mean, every single ending of The Godfather ends terribly for all those characters, every single one of them. And people, for some reason, gravitate to, I don't know why. I mean, I don't think that we should not tell those stories because of people are more interested in the early parts of those films. I also thought that with something like Wolf of Wall Street, who, you know, everyone, I remember when that came out, which is also a Scorsese, people constantly talked about how funny it is. And I know that it is, and like, just as if they were watching a rom-com, you know, like something very light and fluffy and hilarious, like old school or Will Ferrell comedy or something. And often I'm like, well, didn't you see the point, you know? And I don't know why. I don't think I necessarily have the answer to that, but it's certainly an interesting question. Maybe someone in the audience, either my audience or your audience or anyone watching this who's discovering Carl and I for the first time can have some thoughts on that, because it's certainly an interesting thing to bring up. The relationship, though, that he has with Joe Massera, his sidekick at the beginning, I what I find quite interesting is that the scene when he's in a position to have to kill Joe because of what Joe knows about him, and the fact that the cops have been talking to Joe, you know, he saw him kill the police commissioner, he was right there. He's in a position and it's, I love it. So the POV, he's looking right into the camera, approaching him, and you see him start to get emotional in that moment. It's a different side to him completely, and he doesn't do it. And it was a choice he made, which ultimately led to his downfall. And I think that there was certainly a love that they had for each other, a friendship. You know, it sometimes makes me wonder if the fact that, you know, if he wasn't interested in women so much is because maybe he was in love with Joe. I don't know. It's certainly a possibility. But it's quite interesting that was his moment of I don't want to say weakness, but of caution, I suppose, or his moment of consciousness would be a better word for it. I don't know, how did that sit with you?
Yeah, I couldn't remember that moment. It surprised me when it came up again on the rewatch. Right. Like you say, that's his undoing. I have heard people read it as the fact that Rico is gay.
Yeah.
That there's this feeling for Joe. And I hadn't considered that, you know, until I came across that, it hadn't come to my mind, but I can see where that idea comes from.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can, but I suppose it's because...
Oh, certainly.
He shows no interest in women whatsoever.
Yeah, and again, he even makes note of it. And he's not.
Yeah, he says something like loving a woman is soft stuff or something, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah. But yet he has a soft spot for Joe. So I think that's a strong possibility. And you know, in the pre-code era, they would not have been shy to do something like that. You know.
Yeah, and obviously things like he gets, it's when he's when it's pointed out to him that Joe didn't attend his birthday party, that's when he gets kind of a bit sorrowful and stuff like that.
That's right.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I say, you would normally associate like a Rico figure. If this film had come on along a bit later, he probably had a girlfriend at the start, and then he would trade her in for a more beautiful woman. It's kind of, that's right. It's part of how you show that a gangster is moving up in the world. So again, that's kind of a weird aspect of Little Caesar. I suppose I've not heard anything to say that the intent of the filmmakers was to say that the character was homosexual.
Right.
It may have been their intent. I just might not know about it. I suppose it's not explicit in the film, but it wasn't ever going to be, I suppose.
Yeah. Hard to say. I mean, at the time they may have just made that choice so that they can move the story to his downfall. They may have not necessarily been thinking that he was homosexual, but I think it's ambiguous enough that you can interpret it that way. Because it's, as we said, the stories had to be told in such a fast pace and in such short duration that psychology and motivations and exploring details about characters, there wasn't as much time for it. So, which I think is a benefit, because I think it leads to these kind of conversations.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and you know, the storytelling here is, like I say, it is quite taut, and you know, there isn't really a moment wasted.
Right.
I'd be interested to know, on a slightly different topic, but I wonder how a younger audience would respond to this film today.
Mm-hmm.
How would they take Edward G. Robinson? Because I think, being brutally honest, I think what a lot of younger viewers would perceive when they hear him is that they know that the character of Chief Wiggum from The Simpsons was done as kind of an Edward G. Robinson parody.
Wasn't it? I didn't even know that. Is that true? I didn't know that.
I believe that's what I've heard. Oh. I believe that was the inspiration for that character.
Oh, wow.
So I wonder if that would be their immediate kind
of... Yeah, well, it's become very caricature, like the way that they've taken those characters, and same with Cagney, you know, and they've put them into like cartoons and stuff, and people have imitated it for years. But he certainly was the best part of it. It was very common back then for the acting in films to be much broader and over the top. Douglas Fairbanks certainly was much more over the top. But you know, Robinson was very simple, actually, and direct and honest. And you know, that those moments, particularly the POV that I mentioned, when he looks directly into the camera as he's the moment of consciousness, the emotion on his face is totally genuine as he's breaking up. Whereas a lot of the actors in this, but not everybody, as I mentioned, William Collier Jr., who played Tony Passa, and even the woman who played his mother, Farique Barros, who plays Mrs. Passa, that scene was totally honest, and it was not over the top. But everyone else certainly had their moments of just being very broad, but sometimes not. Sometimes it was simple, but in a general sort of way, it was much broader, as opposed to Robinson, who was much more honest throughout. And I think that's probably why he stands out the most.
Yeah, I thought he was magnetic. Honestly, I thought he was really, really good. I love loads of his scenes, but like at the end when he's on the phone to Flaherty, because he's kind of been goaded, isn't he? Because like Flaherty's releasing these quotes to the press to try and entice him out.
Yes, his ego, right? His ego always gets the best of him. And the cop knows that about him.
I hadn't quite appreciated that, like, Edward G. Robinson apparently was a million miles away from the character of Rico. You know, he was like a gentleman figure. He had like, he was a painter. he had a fine art collection, all these kind of things. So it's interesting that this became the role that kind of defined him. And then there were other little aspects to that too. Like, I think in the novel, apparently, and again, that's quite interesting, but it was a novel, and they make sure you know it, don't they? Because like the credit sequence unfolds in the book, which is kind of fun. Apparently the character didn't smoke a cigar in the novel, but that was added for the film. And then that became a bit of an Edward G. Robinson kind of trait as well.
Right.
I wonder how he felt about it being kind of identified with his character for the rest of his career. I mean, he did some other great roles, didn't he? I always immediately think of his performance in Double Indemnity, which is one of my favorite films.
Yeah. Well, you know, he was great at playing like a scholarly type. Like you watch him in The Woman in the Window as he's a professor, even though that's a noir, but he's essentially like a good man in that. And he's totally convincing. I mean, you forget that he was Little Caesar. He was a very versatile actor. Of course, he was, you know, a theater actor. He continued to work in the theater and played all kinds of roles, but he gets most, I think he's most known for this, just like Cagney was most known for his gangster film. Do we see that today? I think when we think De Niro and we think Pacino, even Brando to an extent, we think of them when in their most iconic gangster parts. So yeah. People are just, for some reason, which is hard to peg down, are so fascinated by the actors who were so effective in these kind of parts.
Yeah, and well, you talked about how they become quite easy to imitate or to parody, you know, like by the public. You know, I think anybody could have a half decent stab at a De Niro impression or right. Cagney, you know. Yeah. But then what's interesting is a lot of the time they go on to kind of parody themselves, don't they?
Yeah.
Like you say, Brando's identification with The Godfather, and then he does that film The Freshman. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, I did.
De Niro, of course, has done like Analyze This and various other things. I think Pacino probably has as well.
Yeah, he's done a couple, like, I didn't see it because apparently it's awful, but like Jiggly with J-Lo and Ben Affleck. I think he was doing somewhat of a gangster parody in that and stuff like that. But no, I know what you mean. But for some reason, they you know, it's like if you don't really know their filmography, because I've heard people in the past say, well, those guys always just play gangsters. And I'm like, no, you have to, what are you talking about? You know.
I think that shows how powerful these roles can be, though, doesn't it? Like, I sort of understand why people say that about someone like De Niro. But I also have the same reaction as you, saying, no, hang on a minute, go and look at this and this and this. But it's because he's so riveting, I think, in a film like Goodfellas or Godfather 2 or whatever, just one thing I wanted to say was, I think what's different about this cycle of gangster films to all these later figures is, again, just that sense of directness and it being like ripped from the headlines. Because if you think about it being, this is kind of mirroring something that's going on at the time. I think the further away you get from the early 1930s, that kind of recedes away, doesn't it? Because like, obviously you get like the outlaw films that are about like Dillinger and Bonnie and Clyde and all of that. But by the time you get into like the 50s and 60s or whatever,
70s. That's right. Yeah, there was a lot less of them.
It's a lot less of them, but they still come up, but they're more nostalgic, aren't they? Like you get a nostalgic recreation of the Depression in the Bonnie and Clyde film from 1967, and obviously The Godfather is quite a nostalgic film. So watching something like Little Caesar or Public Enemy, that's what I always think about, is like a lot of that's like still to come. Here, what you're getting is like one, like literally one step removed from like present day history at the time, you know, which is kind of interesting too.
Well, you know, something I read, which I really appreciated, was that Warner Brothers, you know, a lot of at the time, because of the Depression, people who worked there there was a lot of pressure to just have escapist films. And Zanuck, who was, Warner, you know, the heads of the studios, Warner Brothers, they were like, no, we have to push, we should be telling social realities. And thank God they did, because I think, you know, so many of the movies, particularly the Pre-Code, you know, the director here, Mervyn LeRoy, also did a film that I just saw that I love, which was I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang. And that's all about, you know, the chain gangs in the South. And that was, at the time, extremely controversial, and the realities that they brought up. I mean, there was lawsuits and stuff like that. So, I mean, thank God they did, because I think we would be looking back at probably some very, very light stuff, which I think now, if you went to the head of whoever the hell the head of Warner Brothers is now, I don't even know, because the film industry is so different, and we need to be telling social realities, they'd laugh in your face. I mean, because this the industry has changed so much. I mean, I imagine perhaps Netflix or Amazon, they still are doing stories that are more relevant, but there's few and far between. I mean, just the film business has changed drastically. It will be interesting to see what people look back on 40, 50 years as now, you know. It's hard to say, right? I mean, because there's just so much, there's so many stories, TV shows and movies that it's hard to keep up.
Yeah, it's impossible to keep up. That's what I find. And yeah, it'd be interesting to know what the history is. Like, you know, like I said, if there were 100 gangster films made in like 1930 to 1932, that period. But with the perspective we have today, people identify like Little Caesar's a really important one. The Public Enemy's a really important one. Scarface is.
Yeah.
you know, so you sort of need a bit of time to zoom out sometimes, don't you?
Before
you
oh, absolutely. That's the beauty, I think, of film history is just to go back. And I, you know, often when people say, well, the movies are not what they used to, but they forget that what we're looking at now is really like the best of the best. I mean, there's, as you said, 100 films, gangster films from 30 to 32. And I think most of the time people talk about 3 or 4 of those movies.
Yeah. It might be that we talk about the rise and fall as being very important to the genre, and it is.
Right.
But I imagine if you looked at those 100 films, you'd probably find that maybe it's just that the classics employ that structure. There are probably lots of other films that are doing slightly different things that
probably
put into the same genre, you know?
Yeah.
And like with the Warner Brothers thing, it's so important because, yeah, like we say, these films set up a lot of these narrative traits and, you know, characteristics that are going to recur for decades, you know? And so much of it is like just about very specific factors, I think. Like, I think Warner Brothers had invested heavily in sound production, you know, obviously the transition to sound. And then film studios, I understand, were quite financially vulnerable during this era when the Depression hit, you know, because earnings fell, productions had to be scaled back. So like these gangster films were really economical because you could set them in, obviously set in the present day. You know, you could just populate them with performers you had on contract. And again, they were sort of exploiting current news events for their subject matter. So part of a very, like I say, a specific chain of events that led to something like Little Caesar being a really big success, you know?
Yeah.
Some interesting factors behind it.
Yeah, no, it is quite interesting. I appreciate that you looked that up because I know that they were popular films then, but I didn't realize that they were almost a necessity in a way, because it's just like anything else. Like you get a couple of hits and they want 100 more of them. Right.
Yeah. Well, I think that is what happened, isn't it? But very soon, I think just the way Hollywood works, like, okay, let's make more gangster films. And then it's like, well, we've made loads of gangster films. We need to freshen it up. So how are we going to, how are we going to change it just enough that people will still be interested? And I can't remember what year it is, but it's a few years after this. There's a film, Black Friday. I don't know if you heard of that, but it's Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi. It's about an English professor who has a brain transplant and he gets the brain of a gangster. So you're getting like, you know what I mean? They're doing all these variations, like crossing horror films with gangster films.
Yeah, I can see
you
that.
You get obviously the code starts to be enforced a few years down the line from Little Caesar. And you see that like the police become a much bigger part of the story. So you can be a bit more moralistic in your storytelling.
Yeah, I think Cagney even started playing some cops,
G-Men.
You know?
Yeah, G-Men.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. That's a good point. I mean, and it's all within the context of what was happening at the time.
And then you get, I think there are periods like when the Second World War comes and all of a sudden the actors who were associated with playing gangsters were being put to use in like patriotic films about the military, you know, and,
right.
You know, so all these things, these factors that mean the gangster film kind of ebbs and flows. And
yeah.
Like I say, when you get away from like Capone and Dillinger and, you know, Pretty Boy Floyd and all those figures, that, you know, but we still return to them as nostalgic things, you know. Like I've just seen The Many Saints of Newark, The Sopranos.
Oh yeah.
So we're still telling a lot of these stories, which set in the '60s, isn't it, or something? Yeah.
Yeah, people are endlessly fascinated by these stories. And you know, like I said, I mean I am as well. And I mean I think, you know, for better or for worse, sometimes maybe as we've been talking about, maybe the fascination can be for the wrong reasons at times, but for whatever reason, everybody's different. They hold up, who knows how many we'll keep on seeing. But this certainly is a great one for anyone who hasn't seen it. I thought it was a phenomenal film. And did you have anything else you wanted to mention about this film?
I'm just wondering if I had any trivia. Let me just see. There was an interesting story about the casting. I think it's one of those things where people's memory seems to differ, because I'd heard two versions of a similar story. One is that Clark Gable was lined up for the part of Rico.
I read that.
That's one version of it. The other version you hear is that he was actually lined up for the role that Fairbanks Jr. played, Joe. I mean, I can't imagine him playing Rico. I don't know about you.
No, I can't. I could see him
more
as
in
Joe,
the Joe role.
Yeah, I can see that. And I believe Robinson was supposed to play that. He had auditioned for the Joe role, right?
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard that, but that sounds plausible. Yeah, that happens.
Yeah, I read that he they saw him, either they saw him in a play and they felt that he was perfect for Rico, or he auditioned for the film as Joe, the side, his friend, and then realized, I think he would be a lot better as Rico. And the same thing happened with Public Enemy,
yeah,
was that Cagney was supposed to play the other guy, the sidekick.
Because
I forget the characters' names, but...
Yeah. Because in that film, you see the two kids, because you have the flashback, but the early scenes with the kids. Apparently that decision to swap Cagney around the other actor came quite late, because the kid that grows up to be Cagney doesn't look like Cagney as much as the other kid does. It's because they didn't change the kids as well.
Oh, I didn't know that. Whereas if you watch Angels with Dirty Faces, the kid looks exactly like Cagney. I mean, whoever they found, the voice, the mannerisms, was just perfect casting.
The only other bit of trivia I had really was that they wanted to use the phrase Mother of God at the end of the film. I believe that was in the novel and in the script.
Oh, okay.
But
he has to say Mother of Mercy, right?
Says Mother of Mercy. I'm guessing they must have felt it was blasphemous or something, or possibly potentially offensive. And yeah, Mother of Mercy was a more palatable phrase. Right. Didn't know that until I started to have a look around the other day.
Yeah. I'm surprised even in the pre-code that they would have cared.
yeah.
Because, you know, you look at a lot of things that they've said in other movies at that time and you think, wow. But
yeah,
I'm surprised to hear that. That's another interesting trivia fact. There's quite a few on IMDb, just looking through the trivia. I'm sure if people are looking for more stuff, they're just a simple Google. I mean, did you find a lot of that just by doing a simple Google search, or is that on the DVD you got?
There's a decent feature on the DVD. It's about 20 minutes, which is... just a making of, but the interview Martin Scorsese, he talks about, you know, he's interesting because he talks about it as like a morality play and things.
Right.
So there's some good info on there. The DVD I had is pretty good, actually. The commentary is very informative.
Right.
And that pointed out some things to me. So I hadn't actually looked at IMDb.
Yeah, yeah, check it out, because there's some good facts in there as well. Okay. But this has been a great conversation, which is turned more into the review, but also this roundabout way of looking at the gangster genre in general. So I think it's a really interesting conversation that people don't think about as much in terms of the why are we interested in these stories. So if anyone has any opinions or comments, feel free to comment below. This podcast is also available now in an audio version. Not everything that's on YouTube is there, but you can watch, listen to a number of episodes when you're on the go on anywhere that you can get a podcast. I also want to mention my Patreon account, patreon.com/RobertBellissimo at the movies. I will leave the link below in the description box. I actually have a tier which is dedicated to pre-code, as well as to Alfred Hitchcock and film noir, and another one that is general, which is world cinema based. So you could check that out below. And if this is your first time here, please consider subscribing. It's absolutely free to do so. Just click the Robert Bellissimo at the Movies logo. You'll see it right here floating above my head to your top left. Just click on that. You'll see it in just a second. And then click the bell in order to get a notification every time I release a new video or when I go live. Well, Carl, thanks again. I really appreciate that you took the time to come on. I had a really great time.
Please come again. I will. Oh, yeah. I very much will. I think we've always had a good time when we've had these chats. And I think it was a good film, like I say. And I think, like you mentioned, we've talked sort of around the whole sort of gangster phenomenon in terms of cinema. This is a great one for that, because it kind of is foundational to it, and it sort of
absolutely
sets up a lot of the later stuff in certain ways.
Yeah.
So if anyone hasn't seen it yet but has listened to us, please check it out.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me. And just, I guess, in terms of where I can be found, if people are interested in that, I guess Twitter at CKJ Sweeney is the main place. The Movie Palace is at Movie Palace Pod. Just putting together an episode at the moment, which I'm very excited about, which Robert's contributing to, hopefully, which is like a classic film book review episode.
Yeah.
Gonna be a lot of fun, and I know the books people have chosen, and it's just a really, really nice variety coming up there. And that's probably the next new episode I'm gonna have out after this one. So
great.
Yeah, again, thanks for having me, Robert.
Yeah, no, anytime. And I look forward to that review, and I will leave the links in the description box. People want to follow Carl online or check out his podcast, they'll be in the description box below. Well, thanks so much, everyone. I will see you in the next video.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
We dig music.
I like it. I just like it less than Enya.
That was, ladies and gentlemen, the moment where Ian's credibility just disappeared.
I had no problem with that. No problem with that.
I think it's the craziest opinion we've ever had on the show.
It's definitely going to be the most controversial one, I think.
Yeah, it's fine. Because, you know, that's because I'm not moving like a tortoise full of rigor mortis. Which is possibly one of the worst rhyming couplets.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
Yeah, and I think as we're on a Red Dwarf podcast, something we always gush about is the model work of the first six series of Red Dwarf. And that is outstanding, and it is better than this. But for 1967, the model work in this, I don't see where you could say it was anything other than good quality.
Yeah, it was perfectly acceptable, I think, for the time. It was fun, you know. It was fun. I mean, is it the best example of the model work at the time in these films? No, but I certainly wouldn't say it's particularly shonky in any way.
Frame to frame.
With this being done by Bear McCreary, who I believe you may have interviewed, Sean.
I have. He's brilliant.
What did you make of the score?
I really like it. Bear McCreary is a fabulous horror. I mean, he started on The Walking Dead, so that's really how he got his name, with lots of very interesting noises and ambient textures and things. Yeah, on the first Happy Death Day score, he actually used he's got a young daughter, and he used her vocals and distorted them and processed them to create that creepy.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. Hello everyone, this is Tony, network chief of We Made This. As you know, our podcast network brings together a brilliant assortment of talent who talk about all kinds of pop culture content, such as the episode you've just listened to, or maybe you're just about to listen to. We're not going anywhere, but we'd love to keep the lights on for even longer if you're able to support our network on Patreon. For just £2 a month, you get your name in lights and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping us produce more great audio. And for £3 a month, you'll get your name in lights, but you'll also get access to an exclusive bi-monthly podcast from the We Made This talent pool on podcasting, pop culture, and, well, you tell us. We'll take your suggestions. For less than the price of a coffee per month, you can help keep We Made This going. Just head to patreon.com/... We Made This, that's patreon.com/ We Made This, and get the ball rolling. Now, back to your scheduled programming.